This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
What does it look like, do you suppose, when you take billions and billions of dollars out of an economy basically overnight? I ask because we're about to find out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday today, 22 July. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. You know, we used to say all the time on this program that economic headlines are great and all, and you should totally pay attention to them, but it's what regular people are feeling in their day-to-day that really matters. So it's on me for letting that slide, but we bring it back today because a whole lot of people, tens of millions of people, are about to start feeling not so good in their day-to-day. That extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits we have been telling you about go away next week. Then rent comes due right around the corner. Congress is showing no sign it's going to have a new plan in place in time. And that, to quote Mitchell Hartman in our news meeting this morning, is a whole lot of stimulus coming out of this economy all at once. And at a time, one hastens to add, when the economy is not winning against this virus. So we asked Mitchell to get back on the phone with some of the out-of-work people he has been talking to since this thing started to see what not having that $600 a week is going to mean.
If federal pandemic money goes away, the average unemployment check nationwide will drop more than 60% to about $340 a week. Don DeRue and his family have been getting ready.
We've been saving money in anticipation of the bottom falling out of all of this.
Still, they're facing a financial cliff.
We were just talking about that this morning over breakfast. What are we going to do?
DeRue usually works as a host on Morning Drive Time Radio in Truckee, California, a resort area near Lake Tahoe.
That is a fun tune from this new Cor Blund project.
He took a medical leave for an operation in February, and then when the pandemic hit in March, he went on unemployment so he could take care of his two elementary-age kids, who were home from school due to COVID-19. His wife still works, supervising food services at a local hospital. He's been getting around $400 a week in state unemployment benefits, plus $600 a week federal. It's actually a bit more than he was making at the radio station.
Which helped things stay pretty status quo in our house.
But he still doesn't know if school's reopening in the fall. If it doesn't, he'll be at home watching the kids.
If I can't go back to work and the COVID relief ends, we are going to have to move. It seems counterintuitive, but during the pandemic, rents have gone up.
Jody Solel knows what his family is going to do if the $600 a week pandemic payment goes away. More of the same.
We're pretty frugal.
Back in March, he was furloughed from his job at a solar energy installer in suburban Maryland.
I mean, I cut back as soon as I got furloughed. I haven't been in a store other than a grocery store since March. Our credit card bill is like half of what it normally is.
The loss of federal unemployment payments might force him to start charging the cards up again. Starting next week, Solel's unemployment check will be reduced by two-thirds to just $300 a week. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The thing about those jobless benefits, the extended pandemic ones Mitchell was talking about, as well as the regular normal unemployment payments, is that as this crisis got serious, which it did really, really quickly, if you remember back to March, as that was happening, states basically said, hey, you're out of work? Here are your benefits, no strings attached. Now, though, as the crisis grinds on, some states are reinstituting the requirement that people show they are looking for work before they can collect unemployment. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one from the Workplace Culture Desk.
Garrett Honey was furloughed from his job as a test engineer for a casino software company in Denver when lockdown started in March. He'd been collecting unemployment and waiting on his company to call him back when a week ago he got a letter from the state unemployment agency.
And all it says is, hey, you have to find a new job. You have to start looking for one, otherwise you won't get unemployment.
To continue to receive benefits, he'd have to complete 5 work search activities each week, applying for jobs, going on interviews, and accepting a job if it were offered, which put him in a tough spot. Job openings in his field are really hard to come by, with the pandemic keeping most casinos closed or at low capacity, and he'd hoped to keep his old job.
That caused a lot of panic last week.
Such requirements were suspended by most states during the initial weeks of the crisis, but Colorado, along with Nebraska, Arkansas, and Missouri, have reinstated them in recent weeks.
You don't want to discourage people from working if jobs are available.
Angela Rashidi is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. She says in normal times, work search requirements are intended to motivate unemployed people to rejoin the labor market rather than remain on government assistance. In the early days of the pandemic, people were supposed to stay home, not be out looking for jobs, so it made sense to do away with the requirement. But
now we're in this kind of gray area of recovery.
Chris O'Leary is an economist at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. He says while the most stringent lockdowns have eased and some sectors of the economy have reopened, we're not back to normal.
There's kind of on again, off again. Yeah, we're going to have return to work, but oh, wait a minute, the virus is spreading. Maybe we can't.
There's still enormous uncertainty in many industries, like Garrett Honey's. And while the states that have reimposed job search requirements are not hotspots right now, the last months have taught us how quickly things can go bad with a virus that is spreading out of control. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Staying with the theme of the top of the program today, unemployment in this economy right now and the vagaries thereof. We are going to get the weekly report on first-time claims for jobless benefits tomorrow morning. If it's over a million people, that'll be 18 weeks in a row of 7 figures worth of Americans losing their jobs. Wall Street, halfway through this week, a little bouncy, a little choppy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, so the program today is mostly grim, economic news-wise, as you have heard so far, and we'll hear more in a minute. But there is at least one bright spot about which to tell you. Housing. Sales of existing homes were up almost 21% last month, so says the National Association of Realtors. And mortgage applications were up 4%, that from the Mortgage Bankers Association. Now, what can a strong housing market do for a struggling macroeconomy? Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
The home buying process spins a lot of money out into the broader economy. Mark Vittner, senior economist at Wells Fargo, says sellers drive demand for realtor services and advertising. Buyers pay mortgage fees, legal fees, insurance premiums.
And then, of course, when you buy the home, you've got to move there. So you've got to contract out with some movers and you're going to buy some new furniture and home furnishings.
And with mortgage rates near 3%, a lot of homeowners are refinancing their existing mortgages. Adam Levitin at Georgetown says that frees up money they can spend elsewhere.
And that's good for the economy, right? It means that they're not just sinking money into their house. They're now able to go and do home improvements. They're able to buy a new car.
But Levitin says low rates don't necessarily help prospective buyers. That's because lenders are worried about COVID's effect on the economy and have been tightening standards.
If you can get a mortgage, that's wonderful, but it's going to be harder to actually qualify for one.
There also aren't a lot of homes for sale right now. Lawrence Yoon is chief economist at the National Association of Realtors. He says for the homes that are available, we're seeing backlogs of buyers.
Because of the lack of inventory, prices are getting pushed up faster than overall inflation or people's wage income.
Whether or not you can benefit from this housing boom depends on whether you've been able to keep your job during the pandemic, says Paul Habibi at UCLA's Anderson School of Management.
This has really exacerbated a lot of the disconnects we've already had in the market with respect to affordability and homeownership.
Habibi says roughly 1 in 4 homeowners weren't able to make last month's mortgage payment. Lenders have been lenient, but Habibi says that will only play out for so long. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
I was at my local Piggly Wiggly the other day, got up to the cashier, and there, taped to the plexiglass divider, was a sign that said, "Due to the shortage of coins from the Federal Reserve, if possible, please pay with exact change or use debit, credit, or contactless payment." I went with credit, but we don't have enough coins? Well, yeah, kinda. The Federal Reserve has set up a U.S. coin task force with staff members from the U.S. Mint, Walmart, Coinstar, the Fed's own experts as well. Also, Sherry Reagan, she is the executive vice president and CFO of North Salem State Bank. They are in North Salem, Indiana. Ms. Reagan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So where are all the coins in this economy?
The coins are actually still available. They are out in circulation. They just are not moving where they need to be. In 2019, we had 47.4 billion coins in circulation, and currently there's 47.8. So we actually have more out there. They just need to get moving.
Yeah, so that's billions of dollars worth of coins, right? Almost $50 billion worth of coins?
Yeah, there's plenty of coin out there.
Okay, so other than me with probably a couple hundred dollars in milk jars on my dresser and my now abandoned office, they're just not being spent? Is that what's going on? Because people aren't going out there and spending money?
You're right. People have absolutely changed their spending habits during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of shuttered businesses. Mass transit isn't running. Laundromats have been closed. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, you know, our bank customers have been saving coin and bringing it into cash in to go on vacations or trips, and people aren't traveling right now. So they're not taking their coin into Coinstar machines and things like that.
Okay, so as powerful as the Federal Reserve is and as well-intentioned as this task force is, how are y'all going to change consumer behavior? Or do we just have to deal with a coin shortage until, I guess, there's a vaccine, right?
Well, you know, we're currently working on getting communications out to help people address the coin shortage and help address the supply chain, because we believe that it's a supply chain issue and we just need to get the coins back into the right hands.
What happens, though, if I, and look, this is going to sound like a trivial thing, but it's real for so many people. If I have to have quarters to do my laundry and I can't get quarters, what do I do?
And that is the real problem. You know, there's a lot of local retailers who aren't accepting cash right now because they don't have the change to give their customers or they're putting it back on a card. But, you know, these are unprecedented times. We don't really know what it's going to look like in 2 weeks. So we just encourage everyone to look under their couch cushions and in their cars and somehow they get the coin back in circulation.
If you and the Fed and this task force are successful, how long you figure until we're approaching something normal with the coin shortage in this economy?
I don't know that we have any projection of what that's going to look like. I think in some metropolitan areas, bank lobbies are not yet open. So then it becomes, how do you get the coin to the banks? Nobody knows how this pandemic is going to end or how much longer it's going to continue. We're just going to take it one day at a time.
Sherry Reagan is the executive vice president, also the chief financial officer at North Salem State Bank. They are in North Salem, Indiana. She's on the Fed's task force about the coin circulation shortage. Ms. Reagan, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Coming up,
you don't get to a 2 billion euro hole in your accounts overnight.
It's not like there weren't any red flags, y'all. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 165 points on this Wednesday, 0.6%, 27,005. The Nasdaq added 25 points, about 0.2%, 10,706. S&P 500 advanced 18 points, about a half percent, 32.76 there. The federal government said it's going to pay the pharmaceutical company Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech nearly $2 billion to produce 100 million doses of coronavirus vaccines. Pfizer packed on 5%. BioNTech surged more than 13% today. Best Buy said today overall sales are up 15% since it began reopening stores last month. Online sales have tripled in its current quarter. Best Buy picked up 7.8% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down just a touch, 0.59%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A data point from the Census Bureau to set up this next story. More than 8 million people, something like 11% of all the renters in this economy, have no confidence, none, that they will be able to pay next month's rent. As we told you up top and have been telling you for weeks now, that extra $600 a week goes away in a week, as does the federal moratorium on evictions. Dozens of states and cities have rent relief programs in place. But as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, there is not nearly enough money to go around.
So many people applied for Louisiana's new rent relief program that the state stopped accepting applications after just 4 days. In Los Angeles, more than 200,000 renters applied to a fund that will only help about 50,000. And when New York's rent relief program launched,
within minutes of it opening, the website was down.
Sia Weaver is with Housing Justice for All. She says the state's $100 million rent assistance program isn't even an option for a lot of people who need it.
It's not going to help undocumented families. It's not going to help people who work in the cash economy. It's not going to help people who were making 100% of the area median income before the pandemic and are making nothing today.
Eligibility for rent relief varies from city to city and state to state. But in most cases, you have to be able to prove that you're making less because of COVID. And a lot of people getting those $600 checks from the federal government every week are actually making more, like actor Kat Griffin.
Literally every artist is making more now with the boosted unemployment.
Except maybe those on Broadway. But that extra $600 is the only reason Griffin has been able to keep up with rent so far.
On paper, it looks like I'm making more now, but all of that's about to end in literally a week.
And by then, it will be too late to apply for rent relief in New York. For people who do manage to qualify, in most cases, the payments will cover a portion of their rent for a few months. Peggy Bailey of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says the only way to really solve the problem on a national scale
is to provide rental assistance that gets directly to families and individuals through the next federal relief package.
The House has already passed a relief package that does include rental assistance. The Senate is now working on its own version. But we're unlikely to see any final legislation before August. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Don't know if you've noticed, but there's been a whole slew of big companies talking big on climate change lately, promising to be carbon free by such and such a date that is invariably not all that far away given the size of the challenge. Apple is the latest, announcing yesterday it's going to be carbon neutral up and down its supply chain by 2030, which is soon. So, from Marketplace's Andy Euler now, how fast can these kinds of changes actually get done? And oh, by the way, how much is it going to cost?
Apple joins a bunch of companies in its clean crusade. Microsoft says it'll be carbon negative in 2030. Unilever, carbon neutral by 2039. Amazon, neutral a year later. But Edwin Stafford, a marketing professor at Utah State University, wonders whether that will also go for the company's suppliers.
You've got long streams of mining metals and smelting and lithium battery manufacturing, all of these things that are not part of those 100% carbon neutral goals.
Apple's emissions from making its products accounted for 3/4 of its carbon footprint last year. To reduce that, the company's going to have to compel all the firms in its supply chain to emit less carbon too. Joshua Rhodes, a founding partner of Ideasmiths, an energy industry consultancy, says that's easier than it might sound.
The contracts you're signing are worth billions and billions of dollars. And so you can tell your supply chains, you know, you can tell them to jump and they'll say how high.
Apple says it has a commitment for more than 70 of its suppliers to use only renewable energy. Sounds promising, but will they deliver? Elika Kordostami teaches marketing at Rowan University in New Jersey. She says Apple has to be wary of giving consumers a false impression about what they're actually achieving. She says most big companies already have statements of intent on their websites about
how they're trying to protect the environment, how they're trying to make sure that, for example, the ingredients of their products and services is supplied ethically.
And she's not convinced consumers will make sure the companies are actually following through on their promises before they buy. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Over in Germany, financial technology companies, fintech to those in the know, are in the unwanted spotlight following the collapse last month of Wirecard. It's an online payment processor. The company went bust after admitting a huge fraud had been perpetrated and that nearly 2 billion euros, that's more than 2 billion American, was missing. Wirecard was Europe's biggest fintech company. It was something of a source of pride in Germany. So there is some angst right now in Frankfurt. From our European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Wirecard, at its peak here on the Frankfurt stock market, was worth $27 billion. Its collapse has been a terrific shock to the German authorities.
They're horrified. Everybody was horrified.
Dorothea Schaefer of the DIW Research Institute says it's not just the company's creditors, investors and customers who will suffer.
It is really felt that it is a great damage for Germany as a financial center.
The damage stems from Germany's apparent credulity. It wasn't that long ago that Wirecard's CEO, now under arrest on suspicion of false accounting, was hailed as a financial mastermind.
Now we have a special guest. Mr. Braun, please come on stage from Wirecard.
At this major tech conference in Berlin last year, Wirecard boss Marcus Braun was given a platform to brag about his company's superb performance.
And I do not like to show off normally, but we delivered every year in average a 36% share price increase for
investors.
Since
2005.
Since 2005.
Braun was lauded as a rarity, a German tech boss able to compete with the giants of Silicon Valley. And yet alarm bells had been ringing about him long before last month's shock announcement that huge amounts of money had gone missing.
Look, you don't get to a 2 billion euro hole in your accounts overnight.
Dan McCrum of the Financial Times in London.
Something clearly had to have been happening over quite a prolonged time.
He's been writing about Wirecard's dodgy accounting for years. The company angrily accused him of market manipulation. To his astonishment, the German regulator sided with Wirecard and launched a criminal investigation against the journalist.
I mean, you do feel a little like the world has turned upside down when you discover that you're under criminal investigation.
He's been totally vindicated by Wirecard's collapse. And, says independent tech analyst Chris Green, Germany's reputation has been tarnished.
It's definitely very embarrassing at a time when the German financial sector is trying to make a renewed play to be the base for European financial operations going forward.
Frankfurt, heart of the Rhine-Main region. Town and countryside like hand and glove.
With videos like this, Frankfurt has been pushing itself as the European financial centre, able to pick up the mantle from the City of London after Brexit. Berlin has also been pitching to attract more tech companies from Britain. Wirecard is a setback.
It will make Germany a harder sell for technology companies looking to use it as a base.
But German accounting expert Professor Henning Zulch of the Leipzig Graduate School of Management says Wirecard is an exception.
This is one case out of 1,000 good cases.
He insists that Germany's regulatory framework is fine. The Wirecard debacle, he says, was due to serious understaffing at the enforcement level, and that can be fixed.
It's not an indicator that the German market has failed. I would qualify this as temporary embarrassment.
And he says hardly unprecedented, a stock market darling bats away allegations of dodgy dealing, while investors gladly accept the denials so long as the share price continues to dazzle. Not a uniquely German story. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a data point from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that is, sadly, in keeping with the theme of the program today, that not all is well in this economy. The New York Fed puts out a weekly economic index using real-time data to get a sense of what is going on in real time. As of yesterday's report, we are on track for a 7% contraction in this economy in the third quarter. Two things about that. Number one, you will remember a whole lot of people in the Trump administration were promising Q3 would set records to the upside. Number two, you look at the graph, it's at newyorkfed.org, search on weekly economic index. You do that and you will see a clear tipping point to deeper contraction right at the end of June. Okay, we are out of here. Dow Industrials up 165 today, about 0.6%. NASDAQ added 25 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 up 18, that's about 0.5% there. Our media production team, which again, they're the ones going in, so the rest of us don't have to. Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.